Hutcher 20, Israel and Zionism.
The topic of this lecture is Israel and Zionism. This is undoubtedly the most politically controversial of all the lectures in this course on the Introduction to Judaism. I have no doubts that an Englishman or an Arab or an American would tell this story differently about the creation of the State of Israel. I am telling this story as a committed American and a committed Jew and a committed Zionist. There could be other renditions of this story within a course on history or American foreign policy or international relations in the Middle East. But this is the story that I am presenting on Israel and Zionism in the context of an Introduction to Judaism class. With that said, the whole thrust of the Hebrew Bible is getting the Jews into the land of Israel. That is the promised land. It is Moses' last request or last action. God takes Moses up to Mount Nebo and shows Moses the entire land of Israel from north to south. And then Moses expires and is collected to his forefathers. Once the Israelites get onto the land, that's the bulk of the second section of the Tanakh, of the historical prophets. And then, of course, the Jews are exiled from the land. And immediately, when we get to Babylonia, the first thing that we do is we pine and we cry about returning back to the land. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim tishkach yemini. The psalm says, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue stick to my palate. If I cease to think of you, if I do not keep Jerusalem in my memory, even at my happiest hour. Later on, Jeremiah says, thus said the Lord, again there shall be heard in this place, which you say is ruined, without people or beast. In the towns of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem that are desolate without people, without inhabitants, without beast, there will be heard again the sound of mirth and gladness, the voice of bridegroom and bride, the voice of those who cry, give thanks to the Lord of hosts, for the Lord is good, for his kindness is everlasting, as they bring thanksgiving offerings to the house of the Lord, the temple. For I will restore the fortunes of the land as of old, said the Lord. Jeremiah 33. There's this imagination that the Jews will be brought back to the land of Israel, that the temple will be rebuilt, and that the sounds of brides and grooms will once again gladden the streets of Jerusalem. That's in the Bible. When we move to the rabbinic period, the rabbis also created mechanisms by which to promote the status of Jerusalem. As we've already said, the rebuilding of Jerusalem is featured among the petitionary prayers in the daily prayer service. Returning to Jerusalem is also mentioned in the grace after meals, as well as in the Torah service on the Sabbath, on Shabbat. The Passover Seder concludes with singing Hashanah Haba'ah B'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. In ritual ways, in liturgical ways, three times a day when we pray on the Sabbath, what we have is this leitmotif of the Jews returning to the land of Israel. The seven blessings at the center of every Jewish wedding feature those verses from Jeremiah that I just read, reinforcing the notion that Jerusalem belongs to the Jewish people like a bride belongs to her groom. Even the glass that is broken under the wedding canopy is often associated with the destruction of Jerusalem. Let me read to you a few rabbinic comments about Jerusalem from the Talmud. 10 measures of beauty were brought down to the world. 9 were given to Jerusalem and 1 to the rest of the world. This is actually a quote that relates to breaking the glass underneath the chuppah, underneath the wedding canopy at a Jewish wedding. Our rabbis taught, a person may plaster his house, but he should leave a small area bare. A person may prepare a whole banquet, but omit a single dish. A woman may put on her finest ornaments, but she should leave off just one, to remember that we live in an unredeemed world, that we're not yet back in the place where we were meant to be, in Jerusalem. The rabbis also created a law which, on the surface, has nothing to do with Jerusalem or Israel. It has to do with lost objects. If I lose my wallet in the street and somebody else finds it, the question is raised, at what point can the person who found my lost wallet claim it as his or her own? And the answer that the rabbis give is when I, the original owner of the wallet, despair of ever getting the wallet in return. So how does the person who finds the wallet know when I've despaired? It's an interesting question, and the Gemara deals with it. But the moral of the law in the Mishnah is don't despair. Don't despair of getting back what you once had. Abraham Joshua Heschel said that despair is the cardinal sin of Judaism. And as you can see from the Bible to the rabbinic period, the Jews never despaired of getting back to the land of Israel. As we move into the Middle Ages, we have the poetry of Yehuda Halevi. It's a particularly beautiful poem that goes as follows. He's writing this in the 12th century when the Christian crusaders are in control or occupying Palestine. They have arrested control of Palestine temporarily from the Arab Muslims that had been there. And Yehuda Halevi is in Muslim Spain. So that sets the context. In the poem, there's a reference to Edom. Edom is a rabbinic way of talking about Christendom. My heart is in the east and I in the uttermost west. How can I find savor in food? How shall it be sweet to me? How shall I render my vows and my bonds, while yet Zion lies beneath the fetter of Edom, and I in Arab chains? A light thing would it seem to me to leave all the good things of Spain, seeing how precious in my eyes to behold the dust of the desolate sanctuary. Also in Spain, but in the Christian part of Spain, we have Nachmanides, who we've met before in this class. A couple of decades later, he's commenting on the biblical verse in Deuteronomy 33, "You shall take possession of the land and settle in it." What Nachmanides says is that this mitzvah, this commandment, is still in force. There's still a live mitzvah, a live commandment of dwelling in the land and settling it. He even goes so far to say that if the husband wants to make aliyah literally means to ascend, you're ascending to Mount Zion, Jerusalem, but it is the customary term for immigration to Israel. So Nachmanides says that if the husband wants to make aliyah and the wife refuses, she can be compelled to join the husband. What's even more startling is that if the wife wants to make aliyah and the husband refuses, he can be compelled to join the wife in making aliyah. Both Yehuda Halevi, our poet, and Nachmanides agree that prophecy is only possible in the land of Israel. And both leave for the land of Israel by themselves without their families in their old age. So what we see is that poetically, liturgically, halachically, and ritually, returning to the land of Israel is an idée fixe of classical Judaism. As we move into the modern period, there are harbingers of political Zionism. In Eastern Europe, as a result of a combination of nationalism and anti-Semitism, a small number of Jews were motivated to begin considering the possibility of reestablishing a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. No longer should it be a dream, something that we talk about liturgically and ritually, but we should actually move toward the realization of a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. As early as 1843, Rabbi Yehuda Alkali, following the Damascus blood libel of 1840, called for a collective return to Shuvah for the third redemption, the establishment of the third commonwealth. We haven't mentioned what a blood libel is here. I should just mention this. There was a standard anti-Semitic accusation of ritual murder, whereby Jews would take a Gentile, kill the Gentile, and use the Gentile's blood for ritual preparations of ritual food. We see this going back 1,000 years. And in 1840, there was such an accusation in Damascus, and it's called the Damascus Blood Libel. Rabbi Yehuda Alkali raised funds to buy parcels of land from the Turkish Sultan, who was then in control of the land of Israel, and began to establish the infrastructure for a Jewish society. The Zionist enterprise is largely one of fundraising in order to buy property in the land of Israel for European Jews to settle on. Rabbi Alkali is also well known for promoting the rehabilitation of the Hebrew language. Hebrew, up until the 19th century, had only been used for liturgical purposes. Hebrew was not a living language. But beginning in the late 19th century, as a result of the efforts of people like Yehuda Alkali and Rabbi Alkali and Eliezer ben Yehuda, Hebrew was rehabilitated, was resurrected from an ancient language to a living language that now has its share of slang and cuss words and international words as well, largely in Arabic, that can be heard on the streets of Jerusalem and all over the land of Israel today. By 1890, the call to build and return to the land had spread from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, particularly in the writings of Moses Hess. It had also been taken up by secularists like Leo Pinsker. Common to all these writers was the desire to normalize the Jews by giving back to the Jewish nation a Jewish state. In 1894, a French Jewish captain by the name of Alfred Dreyfus was falsely accused of selling military secrets to Germany. He was convicted and sentenced to life on Devil's Island. New evidence later surfaced exonerating Dreyfus, but the military tried to suppress the evidence. Another trial again found Dreyfus guilty of espionage, even though a suicide note by the confessed traitor, a man by the name of Major Esterhazy, had been discovered. The French government ended up falling as a result of the Dreyfus affair. In 1899, the new French president brought Dreyfus back to Paris from Devil's Island. He was only exonerated in 1906, and the family had to wait until 1995 for the French army to admit that it had been mistaken, although they made this admission without issuing a formal apology. Now let's shift to Central Europe, to Vienna, where Theodor Herzl is a young man studying law in Vienna. He decides, after trying his hand as a playwright, that he should become a journalist. He is an emancipated Jew. He is not only an acculturated Jew, but an assimilated Jew with very little formal Jewish education. And he had completely accepted the liberal program of emancipation. He decides to become a full-time writer, so he becomes a journalist. And in 1890, he went to work for the New Free Press of Vienna, and he covered the Dreyfus affair for this newspaper. And it was in France, the home of the French Revolution and the home of Jewish emancipation, that Herzl understood that anti-Semitism could not be cured through granting citizenship and secular education to the Jews. The Jews had to have a state of their own. He believed that it was in the world's best interest to assist the Jews in obtaining political sovereignty in the land of Israel. In 1895, Herzl began outlining his ideas and meeting with Jewish and European statesmen to further his program. He published The Jewish State in 1896, outlining his vision of a secular Jewish state. It should be mentioned that some Zionists were not Jewish. There were many Christian Zionists then, just as there are today, who for religious reasons understand that Jews should be in the land of Israel in order to hasten the second coming of the Messiah, the second coming of Christ. Indeed, then, in Herzl's time, some Zionists were anti-Semites. Yeah, it's a great idea to give the Jews their own state. Let them go to Palestine, let them recreate the land of Israel, and then they'll get out of our state. So to be a Zionist, at a minimum, only meant that one supported the establishment of a Jewish state in the land of Israel. Which, by the way, Herzl was not wedded to the land of Israel. He just wanted a Jewish state, a sovereign Jewish state. By the time we get to 1897 and the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, it was clear that there couldn't be the kind of enthusiasm worked up to create a Jewish state in Uganda or a Jewish state in South America. Israel had to be the place where this third sovereign Jewish state would be recreated. It was also at the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897 that they adopted as their insignia the Shield of David. The Shield of David was a relatively recent symbol of Judaism. What does relatively recent mean when we're talking about Jewish history? Just for the last couple of hundred years. When we go back 2,000 years, the Shield of David or the Star of David was also called the Seal of Solomon. And there were six pointed stars, hexagrams, there were pentagrams, their Christian iconography and Christian architecture also used pentagrams and hexagrams. But by the time we get to the 17th century, we see the Shield of David, as it is now uniformly called, becoming a symbol of Judaism, especially in a lot of the new Jewish architecture that was created by Christians who were looking for a symbol for Judaism, like Christianity had its symbol of the cross. Later on, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, adopted this insignia, the Shield of David, as part of its flag for Israel, and the color blue, the two blue strips above and beneath the Shield of David, as well as the Shield of David itself, which is blue, comes from the blue dye that, according to the Jewish tradition, snails would secrete that would then be used to dye the ritual fringes on the ritual shawl of a tallit. The aims of the first Zionist Congress would be to establish this land of Israel, to establish in the land of Israel a state for Jews. Herzl then said, if not in 5 years, then in 50 years, there will be a Jewish state. And it is to be attained by promoting Jewish agriculture and Jewish industry. Again, conforming to the goals of emancipation in broadening out Jewish vocational skills. Zionist associations and educational initiatives should be implemented. International cooperation should be secured. Now, in terms of international activities, by the end of World War I, we have the British coming into Palestine, which for 400 years, from 1517 to 1917, had been ruled by the Ottoman Empire, by the Turks. So now the Brits are in control of Palestine. The Balfour Declaration was issued in 1917. And the Balfour Declaration says, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use its best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That was the Balfour Declaration that Chaim Weizmann, who becomes Israel's first president, was able to work out with Britain shortly after the conclusion of World War I. 5 years later, in 1922, Britain, under pressure from the Arabs, cut away three-quarters of what was Palestine, everything to the east of the Jordan River, and created a new Arab entity called Transjordan. This was in order to placate the Hashemites, who were cousins of the royal family from Saudi Arabia, from the Sauds. The League of Nations later in 1922, the League of Nations was the precursor to the UN, approved the Balfour Declaration and established the British Mandate, whereby Britain assumed responsibility for the implementation of the Balfour Declaration. The British Peel Commission of 1937, prompted by Arab riots against Jews, which began in 1936, concluded that the remaining territory west of the Jordan River should be divided between Jews and Arabs, with the Arabs receiving Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and a corridor to the sea. This was not at all what the Zionists had hoped, but nevertheless, because they were offered an independent state, they reluctantly accepted the plan. The Arab leadership summarily rejected it, the first of many rejections. Continued Jewish immigration and Arab terrorism triggered the White Paper of 1939, whereby the British severely curtailed Jewish immigration on the eve of World War II and the Shoah. David Ben-Gurion, who was the chairman of the Jewish Agency and later becomes the first prime minister of Israel, said, "We shall fight the war against Hitler as if there was no White Paper, and we shall fight the White Paper as if there was no war." All in all, 26,000 Palestinian Jews fought for Britain in World War II. At the end of World War II, we have a period of time where there's some immigration to the land of Israel. And then in November 29th, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted to partition Palestine into Jewish and Arab states, with Jerusalem under international sovereignty, which is not so different, actually, from the last suggestion that was touted in a peace plan between the Israelis and the Palestinians, to have Jerusalem be under divine sovereignty. But that wasn't thought of in 1947. So there would be a state for the Jews and a state for the Arabs in Palestine, and Jerusalem, the most contested of cities, that would be under international sovereignty. The partition plan in the UN passed by a margin of 33-13, with the United States and the Soviet Union voting in favor. Britain abstained. So much for the British mandate of establishing what it called for in the Balfour Declaration, a home for the Jewish people, a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And Britain stated that it would do nothing to enforce the plan. So Britain then begins to pull out of Palestine following this UN vote. And in May 14th, 1948, David Ben-Gurion, who was the chairman of the Jewish Agency and the first prime minister of Israel, proclaimed the establishment of the State of Israel. Now, in terms of the Jews and the Arabs' posture toward that UN resolution, again, the amount of territory that was offered by the UN was significantly less than what the Zionists had dreamed of, but it was a state nevertheless, and so they decided to accept the UN resolution, partitioning Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. The Arabs, again, summarily rejected the plan. Thus, on May 15, 1948, the day after David Ben-Gurion's proclamation of the establishment of the State of Israel, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, which is now called Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Iraq all sent troops against Israel to wipe out the Jews, to push them into the sea. The Arabs succeeded in losing more territory to the Jews than the UN partition plan had offered them. Nevertheless, the holy city of Jerusalem was in Jordanian control until the 1967 Six-Day War. Due to the Arab rejection of the UN partition plan, the Arab state in Palestine was stillborn, and we are now trying to negotiate a new state of Palestine for the Arabs in that land. And remarkably, for the first time in contemporary Israeli history, both major political parties in Israel, Labor and Likud, are on record as saying that there should be an independent state for the Arabs in the land of Israel. And now it's a process, hopefully, of working out the details. Despite wars and economic boycotts and terrorism, Israel continues to serve as a haven for Jews throughout the world and as a democratic beacon amongst a sea of totalitarian regimes. Israel's contributions in high technology and medical technology and healthcare, agriculture, and solar energy lend a degree of credibility to what's written in conservative and modern Orthodox prayer books. that the state of Israel is the beginning of the flowering of redemption. This is a controversial claim, that the state of Israel is the beginning of the flowering of redemption. Because after all, the Zionists who settled the land and who drained the swamps and who planted the farms in the desert that made the desert bloom, in David Ben-Gurion's memorable phrase, they were not at all motivated by messianic fervor or by a commitment to traditional Judaism or traditional halakha. What motivated them was a desire to solve the Jewish problem, to find a national home so that the Jews could be just like any other people. David Ben-Gurion has a great line that we want to be a normal people with cops and robbers and policemen and prostitutes, just like everybody else. Israel has an abundance of those elements in society now, so David Ben-Gurion should be happy on that score. But the idea was to become not a light unto nations, but a normal nation, just like everyone else. Indeed, Israel has a Declaration of Independence. Israel does not yet have a constitution, but in Israel's Declaration of Independence, God is not mentioned. There was a compromise worked out whereby the term the Rock of Israel, Tzur Yisrael, was mentioned, and religious folks understand that that is a reference to God, and folks that are not religious can understand it any way they wish. But within the religious world of conservative Judaism and modern Orthodoxy, unlike some of the ultra-Orthodox groups who are anti-Zionist, as we saw in the lecture where we talked about the Holocaust and some of the ultra-Orthodox Jews understanding the Holocaust to be a punishment for Zionism, conservative and modern Orthodox Jews understand that redemption's not here, but redemption can't happen unless the Jewish people are back in the land of Israel. It doesn't negate the existence of the diaspora. Jews can still live outside the land of Israel. But in order for the Jewish mission to be complete, the Jews need to have a nation in order to actualize that biblical model of living righteously in God's eyes, not just as individuals, but as a community and indeed as a nation. And this is a tremendous challenge given the neighborhood that Israel inhabits. So the idea that Israel is the beginning of the flowering of redemption is indeed optimistic, but Judaism is optimistic. The idea that history has a direction, that we can't despair no matter how seemingly terrible the world feels, is part and parcel of this Jewish outlook. Now that we've entered the 20th century in full steam, our next lecture brings us back home to the Judaisms of America in the 20th century.